Hey friends, Landon here. Welcome to the Waterville Community Church Sunday Podcast. We hope this message will help you to know God, grow in your faith, and go where He sends you. In a hostile, divided world, Jesus prayed that His followers, the church, would be one. Sadly, the church often reflects the hostility and partisanship we experience in culture rather than representing an alternative way. In this series, we're going to be discussing the essential convictions that originally distinguished Christianity from other belief systems and united people from different tribes, tongues, nations, and people groups into a global community that redefined the human experience. Perhaps the key to unity in our day is revisiting the foundational convictions found in what we call the Apostles' Creed and recommitting ourselves to them.
We believe in God.
God, the Father Almighty.
God, the Father Almighty. Creator of heaven and earth.
Creator of heaven and earth.
Creator of heaven and earth.
We believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth.
If you're attending, whether you're here in person or you're attending online, this morning's going to be a little weird for me. You're going to have to be gracious to me. You know, for 4 months, I've been standing in one spot. There's an X on the stage that you used to say O'Shea home, which was like, don't move, right? Stand right here, which is not my normal speed. I mean, normally, you know, I like to move around, but there's nobody in the room to talk to. So this morning, obviously, I'm going to be talking to people who are here, talking to people who are not here. That's going to be our new speed, new rhythm, which is going to take probably some adjusting to get used to. But I really am. I'm glad that you're here. Like I said last week, you know, this morning for me is sort of a mixture of joy and sadness, right? I'm full of joy to see people here. I'm also sad that obviously a lot of us aren't here, and we're still in this very difficult season. This is a new step or new stage, but we're still in this season, and we're going to continue to go through it together. So I made the decision. I thought about, you know, when we decided to open the doors and bring people back or invite people to come back on July 5th. I thought, you know what, that's going to be obviously going to feel very different. Maybe on July 5th we should, you know, just step back from this series that we've been in and just have a different kind of conversation. And the more I thought about it, that was my first inclination, and then I thought about it some more, and I was like, you know what, no, let's do that the week before. Because I think there's something about, we're here, we're in this room, we haven't been in this room together for 4 months. I want to talk about what we talk about when we gather as a faith community, and that's God. We talk about God. And so we've been in this We Believe series, we're talking about the essentials of the Christian faith that have been handed down to us in what we call the Apostles' Creed, the series we call We Believe. So we've done 3 weeks of basically of setup. So we spent a week talking about why core beliefs are so important. Why was it so necessary for the early Jesus movement to codify, to write down what made it distinct? Because if you don't do that, over time, the movement either morphs into some other movement or no movement at all. And so they wrote some things down. We spent a week talking about the relationship between this creed and the Bible. That the best way to think about the Apostles' Creed is as a summary, a Cliff's Notes, of the story that the early church believed the Bible was telling. And so not only is it a summary of the story, but then it also becomes for us, anytime many of you have probably read the Bible, a lot of professing Christians have not. If you ever do open it up and read it cover to cover, it's a big, very complicated book, and there's a lot of stuff in there. And so one of the ways that the creed really helps us is as a guide. You open up this book and you try to read it, the content of the creed is there as a sort of, hey, these are the boundaries. This is the essential narrative, the story that's being told. It keeps you from, you know, sort of running off on tangents. So we talked about that for a week. A couple weeks ago, Dustin talked about the sacramental nature of the creed, that in the early church in the first few centuries, if you were going to become a Christian believer and enter the Jesus movement, it was the stuff of the creed that you were taught. because our belief in God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, it is the core of Christian faith. Everything else that we believe is built on that experience, not theory, but experience with God through the person of Christ in the Holy Spirit. So we've done 3 weeks of setup. This morning, I want to dive into the first clause of the creed. Right, we believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. I'm gonna, even though Father Almighty comes before creator of heaven and earth, I'm gonna, for the sake of conversation, I'm gonna flip them and spend most of the time this morning talking about creator. And then next week we'll pick up Father Almighty. I just think it'll communicate a little better. So it should go without saying, but the Christian person believes that at the center of reality isn't a idea or a concept or a force or a power or a theory or a principle, but a personal being that we call God. Now, you're all here. I assume you believe that already, maybe. To some people, belief in God is, it's incredible. And that the number of people, especially in Western culture, who would say that there's no such thing as a God, that population's growing. But statistically speaking, belief in God is still the overwhelmingly majority position. That of the roughly 8 billion people on this planet, 90% believe in some kind of higher power, divine being. Over 50% believe in a single personal God. Now, the reason I bring that up is because we believe in God. Those are the first words of the creed. We believe in God. I could spend a lot of time this morning trying to offer some counter arguments to people who say there's no God or belief in God is sort of incredible, and here's why. But statistically speaking, I don't know that that's the actual problem. And it's easy for us to do that. We can spend a lot of time in our lives thinking this is the problem, and investing a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of resources trying to solve this problem when this isn't really the problem. The actual problem's over here. But we don't ever talk about it or focus on it. We could spend a lot of time and energy in the church trying to address the very loud voices that would have people believe that God isn't real and there's no good reason to believe in God. But statistically speaking, that's not really an issue. 90% of the people on the planet believe in a God. 50% of people believe in a single personal God. You are probably here because on some level you either believe in God or you're at least open to the idea. So I'd rather not spend the time making arguments for why I think believing in God is rational and makes sense and there's evidence for it and yada, yada, yada. I'd rather talk about why believing in God is supposed to mean something. Right? The issue for me is not getting people to believe in God. It's getting belief in God to mean something. That's what I want to talk about this morning. It was about 20 years ago, back in 2002, there was a huge study done on adolescent spirituality, teenagers, religion and spirituality among adolescents in the U.S. It was the largest study of its kind, thousands of teenagers all over the country, different faith systems, so not just Christian, but then also like a bunch of different denominations within Christianity. Survey and focus group interviews, thousands and thousands of kids. It was the largest study done of its kind. At the time, I was working for an organization called Young Life, which works with teenagers. Anybody who works with teenagers is probably familiar with this study, has probably read books that were done based on it. Anyway, one of the books that was written based on the data was written by a couple sociologists, Christian Smith, who's at Notre Dame, and Melinda Denton, who is at Clemson. And they wrote a book called Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. They suggest a lot of things in the book based on the data from all of these surveys and focus group interviews, conversations. Here are a few. I've just distilled them. One is that without question, parents are the most significant influencers of their kids. So churches are important, schools are important, coaches are important, but without question, like everything else in life, the most important influencer in the life of a teenager is a parent or guardian, hands down. That was one thing. The second is that contrary to popular belief, and this is before my time, but I think this was your fault. For all of you hippie hellraisers in the 60s and 70s, it sort of solidified in our consciousness that like teenagers are by nature kind of contrarian and rebellious. you know, that they just can't wait to shuffle off the, you know, oppressive shackles of their parents' religion. Statistically speaking, that is not true. Teenagers are actually conventionalists. They are perfectly happy to accept the beliefs and the spirituality of the environments in which they grow up. They're conventionalists. The third thing that Smith and Denton point out is that, by and large, teenagers are remarkably inarticulate when it comes to expressing faith and spirituality. They can't talk about it, which either means they don't have any idea what they believe, or they just have gotten no assistance on how to talk about it. I'm gonna give you an example. There's hundreds of examples in this book, and obviously thousands in the study. I'm gonna read you one that I actually think is among the better. This was a 17-year-old kid in Indiana, and again, the question was, what are your most important beliefs? Or what beliefs do you think are central to your faith? So these are religious kids claiming to be religious, spiritual, go to church, whatever. What are your most important beliefs? This is a 17-year-old kid in Indiana. I think if you're a good person and, like, you know, you don't break any huge, I mean, if you live your life around the basic structure, you know, I mean, nobody's perfect, so you're going to do bad things, but, like, the whole Ten Commandments and stuff, I mean, pretty much a good person. Then when you get judged, you get to have another life. If you ask forgiveness and pray a lot, you have a pretty good chance, just because, you know, the whole forgiving God thing. I mean, like, I'm not picking on teenagers. I mean, I worked with teenagers for a long, long time. Teenagers can be remarkably articulate about some things. If this were a job interview, that kid's not getting the job, right? I'm not picking on teenagers. I'm using this study of teenage adolescence and spirituality to tee something up that I hope you can see coming. Parents are the number one influencers of their kids. Kids are, by and large, conventionalists, which means they're perfectly happy to believe whatever you tell them. Three, they have no idea what they believe or why and can't talk about it. You see where I'm going with this? You put the pieces together. The average adult has no idea what he believes, why, or how to talk about it. And well, I'm not talking about people who are out there. Okay, like, I want you to think about this for a minute. If you sat down and someone said, could you please tell me what are your most important beliefs, what would you say? Because there are a lot of wonderful church-going people whose answer might sound something like that. I mean, this wasn't entirely devoid of substance, right? I mean, he threw the Ten Commandments in there, prayer got a shout out, God's forgiving, that found its way in. I mean, like, it wasn't totally devoid of substance. The point here is that the average adult has no idea what he believes, why, or how to talk about it. That's what I want to talk about this morning. We believe in God. What does that mean? Why is it important? What do you think you're saying when you say that? Is it just one among many kind of, it's true, it's a fact, but it's a sort of inconsequential one? I mean, there's lots of things that are true, that are factual, that they don't really drive much of our lives. I mean, I believe 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't make a big difference in my life on most days. Is it a sort of inconsequential fact? Is it just an opinion? It's just an opinion. You know, a lot of people think about religion and spirituality that way. That is one of the outcomes of the study was this is, by and large, how most people think about religious faith. Is like, this works for me, that works for you, this is just my opinion, you have a different opinion, and that's just kind of, is it just an opinion? Which, again, they're fine as they go, but they don't really matter much. I mean, I think wedding cakes are overrated. I believe that Die Hard is the greatest Christmas movie ever made. I believe you can wear whatever color you want to wear after Labor Day. I mean, these are not like, they're opinions. They're fine as they go, but they don't matter a whole lot, right? Are we just expressing some kind of inconsequential fact? Are we sharing an opinion that's, you know, it's just kind of in the grab bag of opinions out there? What does it mean when we say that we believe in God? See, this is why creator language is so important, right? Of all the things that the creed writers could have said about God, based on all of the things that had been said about God up to that point, one of the things that they chose to summarize the character God was creator. Because by establishing God as creator, you are identifying God as primary cause. The fancy term that we use in Christian circles for God as creator is ex nihilo. It means out of nothing. So we believe that God, because God is creator of heaven and earth is everything. So that means God creates out of nothing. Everything that we make out of the stuff that God makes. God makes out of nothing, ex nihilo. So I read this joke in a book once. This is such a cheesy church joke, which I told myself I'd never do, but I've been pastoring for a while now, so you just start to do it. Anyway, some scientists come to God, and they say, hey, God, you know, who do you think could make the better human? You know, it's like a little contest. And God says, okay, I'm up, I'm game. So they meet up, and you know, God takes his lump of clay, and he gets to work on Adam 2.0, and he notices that the scientists are doing the same thing, and so he gets up, and he walks over to the table, and he says, excuse me, fellas, that's my clay. You want to make a human out of dirt, you're going to have to make your own dirt, right? Like, that's the idea, that God creates out of nothing. We make stuff out of the stuff that God makes, or we make nothing at all. And why this is important is because if God creates out of nothing, then God gives meaning to everything. If God creates out of nothing, then God gives meaning to everything. The earliest followers of Jesus were well aware that there's a certain logical force to the idea that God is primary cause. God is creator. The Apostle Paul, many of you are familiar with the Apostle Paul. He was a prolific church planner, wrote most of the second half of our Bible, the New Testament. When he was in Athens, city of Athens, he's having this conversation with some high-level thinkers. Athens, you know, is the birthplace of philosophy. And one of the things that he says to the philosophers in Athens is he says that in him, in God, we live and we move and we exist. That Paul was a God-fearing Jew. He understood and believed God to be creator, and he knew that that had certain logical force, that if God creates out of nothing, then it is God who gives meaning to everything, because everything was created by God. So it is in God that we live and we move and we exist. There's a certain logical force to it. God is primary cause. God precedes. Another way to say this is that you and I enter into the world God created, not the other way around. And the way that you hear the average person, including the average Christian person, think and talk about God and about faith and about spirituality, you would think it was the latter, not the former. Rather than God and then everything else, right? If you're going to say you believe in God, then everything else you might say or think or believe or do should kind of logically come from that place. Okay, God, now what? And there should be some sort of logical connection there. The average person, when you hear them talk and think about God, it's you would think that we're in the business of creating a world and we'll invite God into it so long as it sort of serves our purposes. I mean, Western culture, the world in which you and I live, is awash in a way of thinking about life that is the Smith and Denton, the language they use, they call it therapeutic individualism. What they mean is, and you know this to be true, and we've talked about this here. I mean, you think about your own life, think about the way you see other people operate. Therapeutic individualism, it means, one, as an individual, that you think of yourself, or the average person thinks of himself, as a self-contained, autonomous, a sole arbiter of what is true and good and right. That you don't have to look outside of yourself for truth or rightness, that all of that you can find either within, or you simply become the person who gets to decide on everything. So you are the sole arbiter of all that is true and good and right. That's the sort of pervasive individualism. The therapeutic part is that we seem to believe that everything in life is there to kind of help us realize whatever our goals and dreams and aspirations happen to be. That the whole purpose of life is for us to be happy, to be successful, to find enjoyment, to be self-fulfilled, to be whatever. It's all about us and whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish. And God, among everything else, is a sort of means to that end. So I'm out creating a life for myself. I get to decide whether God is a meaningful component of that or not. And that's largely based on not whether or not God exists or not, which once you say yes or no, should kind of determine everything. So it's not whether it exists, God exists or not, but whether God will help me. Do I think God will solve my problems? Do I think God can answer my questions? Do I think God will make me happy? Do I think God will, bring a spouse into my life or help me have kids or make me rich or whatever the stuff is? Christian people don't believe that. Christian people have never believed that. We believe in God, the creator of heaven and earth. And what that means is God creates the world and you and I enter into it, not the other way around. That there's certain logical force to the fact that when we say God, we believe in God, creator of heaven and earth. God is primary cause. God creates out of nothing, and therefore God gives meaning to everything. Which means, among other things, that God makes claims on your life. Christianity isn't it's not a theory. It's not a philosophy. It's not even a worldview primarily. I mean, it is, but it's not. There's a profession of belief based on an experience in the world that once you say it, once you say, I believe in God, the creator of heaven and earth, you're saying there's primary cause, that you do not get to determine what is true and what is not true, that you don't get to make up what the world is about and what makes it meaningful or what doesn't make it meaningful, that the world and your life comes from some place, comes from someone, and finds meaning in God. God gets to make those determinations. Now, that should be irrefutable. Again, you might be wrong. By saying that you believe in God, you could be wrong. But once you say it, it should have the kind of logical force to drive everything else. In other words, you can't say, I believe in God, the creator of heaven and earth, but it doesn't really matter. That's what I'm trying to get at. There is no such thing as faith or religion or spirituality having a kind of component of your life. It cannot, by definition. If God exists and God is creator, then God's primary cause. Everything derives from that. But of course, as the study pointed out, and as you know in your own personal life and in your relationship with lots of people, we seem perfectly comfortable saying that we believe in God, creator of heaven and earth, but it doesn't really matter much. People do this all the time. They do it every day. So even though it should have the kind of logical force that makes that sort of thing impossible, it happens all the time. Why is that? What should be impossible, logically, rationally, is perfectly possible and common. Well, it's because we're not purely rational. Right? I mean, some of us aren't even mostly rational. And we're all irrational at one point or another. My point is, we're not computers. Human life is not data input, output. You are not defined by what you believe. You're defined by what you love. You're not defined by what you believe. You're defined by what you love. I think what this study points out is the reason that teenagers cannot talk about what they believe or why is because the adults who are influencing them can't talk about what they believe or why. And the reason adults can't talk about what they believe and why isn't because they don't have beliefs, but because they don't love the object of the belief. It's just simply not important. I want you to think about something for a minute. Think of the things that you love the most. And just for the sake of the conversation, let's assume God's not on that list. Okay? Just take God out of the, put God on a table over here. Think of the other things that you love the most. I think about my wife. I think about my kids. I think about my family. I think about my friends. I think about, you know, my favorite pastimes, the way that I like to spend my time, right? Those are the things that immediately come to mind. What comes to your mind? Can you talk about them? Can you talk about them easily without any effort? Can you talk about them articulately? Do they actually shape what you think and how you speak and what you do and don't do? How you spend your time, how you spend your money, where you go and don't go? Mine do. Not because I believe in them, but because I have a love for them. And the same is true in your life. Your love for something elevates it, makes it center stage in your life, and everything else takes shape around those primary loves. Spouse, kids, you know, hobbies, friend, whatever the loves are. You're not defined by what you believe. You're defined by what you love. I might say it this way. You believe what you love. You believe what you love. I mean, it's clear to me, you know, reading this book that, and you would do the same thing. You know, someone walks into a room and you know, they're an interviewer and they say, hey, do you believe in God? And just like, oh, yeah, I believe in God. Yeah. And then he's like, you know, how important would you say God is to you? Oh, real important. Real important. God's like right up there, like number one. I mean, you would do the same thing. But if you start drilling in, hey, explain to me why you think that. You're eventually going to get to a place where you realize you're not defined by what you claim to believe. You're defined by what you love. That what you actually believe is what you love. Because what you love, you're not a computer. You're not purely rational. You're passionate. You have desires. The Christian church has always known this. The first commandment is not believe in God. It's not fear God. It's not even obey God. What is it? Love God. It's love God. See, the creed writers, when they say we believe in God, creator of heaven and earth, they're not just making a proposition that has certain logical force. It is that, and it should be that, but that's not all they're doing. Declaring that God is creator of heaven and earth, it's an invitation. It's an invitation into a story. Stories are about something. Stories are about people. Right, the creed is a summary of the story that the creed writers believe the Bible's telling. What are the first words in the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The first words. This is how the story begins. If you were to just hand this, you know, a Bible to somebody, I don't have one with me. If you just hand a Bible to somebody and say, here, they've never read it, they have no idea what it is, so just take it and read it, the story begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, every one of Jesus' earliest followers already knew that. This was in their sacred text. They believed God to be a creator. But then they had an experience with Jesus Christ. I mean, if you've never opened up the Bible and read it from the front to the back, it says a lot of things about God. It says a lot of things about God, and you can just get lost in it, in the complexity of it, in just the scope and the breadth of it. But the story begins with God as creator. They believed that God was creator. But then they had this experience with the person of Jesus Christ. Christianity is not, it's not a theory. It's not a worldview. It's not a philosophy. It is those things. But it is ultimately a movement, and it's a movement based on what somebody saw and heard. that one of Jesus' earliest followers, in a letter that he wrote, he said, we are sharing with you, we are writing to you, we are bearing witness, we're testifying to what we have actually seen and heard so that you can have fellowship with us, right? Their understanding was that the same God who created the heavens and the earth from the very beginning showed up in this person, Jesus of Nazareth. They saw him, they heard him, they lived with him. They watched him die, and 3 days later, they watched him rise from the dead. And they were totally convinced. And every single writer in the New Testament makes a statement like this. I'll just give you one of them. Every single one makes a statement like this. They were completely convinced that God's full character, full nature, was on display in the person of Jesus. The author of Hebrews says that the Son radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God. This was their way of saying, you know what, if all you had were the first three quarters of the Bible and you never got to Jesus, you would be real confused. You'd be real confused. You'd have a very hard time saying definitively, God is like this. Because there's a lot of stuff in there. Right? One author says the problem with what the Bible says is everything else the Bible says. You'd have a real hard time. Their conviction was, when God showed up in the person of Jesus Christ, it was like, here is all of God, condensed into a human person that we can see and hear. Through their experience with Jesus, they didn't have any problem anymore talking about who God is and what God is like. They could say very clear things like, God is love. It is true that if you open up the Bible, you're going to see some things that God doesn't look very loving, right? But their experience with Jesus was, no. God is love. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. These were things that you could not have said before. But because of their experience with Jesus Christ, what they realize is that the story begins with creation. God creates the heavens and the earth. And then God enters into creation. Why? Well, to fix it. For God so loved the world that things had gone horribly wrong. That they were acutely aware that this creation of God's that was declared good, it didn't feel good all the time. It didn't look good. Something was obviously wrong. And there was a lot of conversation about, why is that? Why is the world the way that it is? Why do people do what they do? Why are things the way they are? And how does God feel about it? And what's God doing about it? Well, their conviction through their experience with Jesus Christ was that the same God who created showed up to recreate. That for God so loved the world that God actually showed up. And because they experienced God's love through the person of Jesus Christ, their response was not just belief, it was love. They didn't walk away from the empty tomb and from their post-resurrection conversations with Jesus, sitting down, having like rational conversations like, well, by virtue of the fact that he rose from the dead, this is logically what this means, and we're going to have to logically do blah, 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 blah. They fell in love, and it changed their lives, and it changed the world. They fell in love. When you fell in love, it changed your life, and it changed your world, and it changed everything about you and, consequently, everything around you that you touch or get involved with. They fell in love with God. And it changed them. And it changed the world. Now we have 3 billion people on the planet who profess faith in God or faith in Jesus, and by and large, it means nothing to anyone. It's background noise. It's the kind of thing that you, I believe in God, but it's not really that big a deal. Imagine ever saying that about your spouse or your kids. I hope you would never say, I believe in my wife. I love my wife. She's over there. You know, she mostly hangs out in that room. It doesn't really matter. She's there, but it doesn't really matter. You would never say that. You could not possibly live that way, assuming you actually loved the person you're speaking about. The scandal of faith is that so many people could sit in a room with an interviewer, and when asked, what are your most important beliefs? They would say, oh yeah, I believe in God. I believe in God. But functionally speaking, no, they don't. Because what you ultimately believe is what you love. And the reality is that a lot of us, and it doesn't make any sense to me. It boggles my mind. I don't know why you wouldn't love God. I don't get it. If you've experienced God the way I have, I don't get it. But that's the scandal. That's the issue. The issue is not getting people to believe in God. The issue is getting belief in God to mean something. That, yeah, God created out of nothing, and therefore God gives meaning to everything. And if you want to think of yourself as a purely rational, logical human, that should be all you need. Computer data input, and there should be a certain output. But I think for most of us, that's not who we are. Most of us have to do a little gut check on when we say that we believe in God, creator of heaven and earth, is that coterminous with us saying we love God? That we believe God has created the world, has created our lives, and that for so God loved the world and loved our lives, that God actually did something. That if it's something we've experienced or something we're aware of, that the only appropriate response would be love in return. And that it is that love that would then drive everything about us. Would elevate God to center stage, and God would become like that fixed piece around which everything else has to move and shift. God created the world that we enter into, not the other way around. And next week, I'm going to talk more about the why, right? Father Almighty language, why? Why does God create? And it is for so God loved, that love is at the center of the universe. For so God loved us, we're created to love God. So that's the challenge, is if you're at a place where you want to say, I believe in God, the creator of heaven and earth, ask yourself the question, functionally speaking, not theoretically speaking, functionally speaking, do you actually love this God that you profess to believe in? We're going to finish our service this morning by taking communion.
If you had questions during the message, text them to 567-246-0807, and we will address them during our next Facebook Live Q&A. For additional content, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our website, watervillecc.org. You can also watch our live stream service on YouTube every Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern, or replay at any time. Thanks for listening.